Yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Today's guest is Zoe Zamudzi. And Zoe will be talking about her new book, As Black as Resistance, that she co-authored with William C. Anderson. This book is out now on AK Press. I highly suggest people go out and pick it up and read it. I really loved reading the book. It was short. It wasn't, you know, one of these 600-page books. And what made the book a little different than a lot of books that I read about anarchism is that it was really logically and factually laid out to make an almost scientific argument as to why we cannot look to the state, as to why black people cannot look to the state as a guarantor of freedom or rights, and how essentially black people in the United States are a stateless people without citizenship. And they really talk about the need for self-defense, and they look at the Seminole War as like one of the critical pieces of history as to like what black resistance linking up with indigenous people in North America could look like. And they really stress the need to link up struggles of indigenous people with a black struggle in the United States. And yeah, and just about how like calls to respectability and trying to like win liberals over ends up just being essentially pacifying movements. And because essentially liberals, white liberals, want the status quo. They're not looking to have a revolution. They're not looking to radically overturn society. They're looking for a kinder gender capitalism. This is an awesome interview. I really enjoyed it. I'm not going to blab on forever about it. If you dig the interview, give us a shout out on Twitter, and more importantly, go pick up this book and, support this work so that these folks can keep writing. And if you dig this podcast and you want to support it, feel free to go over to Patreon, patreon.com/SOLEONE, and sign up for $1 a month, whatever. But the more people on there, the better. Helps me grow this work. And and let's just get right into this interview. And before I bounce off of this intro, let's hear from some comrades in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
Where did you get this?
Your friendly neighborhood anarchist.
More of an anarchist militant.
People involved in social struggles than everybody else.
People have been waiting for some content.
Radio.
And show.
The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Percy Goodness.
The Final Straw Radio.
If you're listening, you are the resistance.
Zoe, welcome to the Soulcast. How you living?
I'm pretty good. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I really, really love this book. It's fucking awesome.
Thank you so much.
So you're getting ready to go to Africa?
Yeah, I'm heading to Namibia tomorrow.
What are you doing out there?
I'm doing field work for my PhD, or I'm starting the field work for my PhD. And I'm studying the Namibian genocide and the Nazi Holocaust and kind of black indigeneity over there.
Oh, wow. Wow. Have you been to Africa before?
Yeah. To Zimbabwe, to South Africa, to Swaziland to visit with family, but I've never been to Namibia.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. When you said you're going overseas, I just thought it was like some university in Europe or something. And I was,
that could be cute too, but no.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I thought I'd start with kind of how you closed out the book, because I thought that was pretty powerful. You were saying like Nina Simone said that freedom is to have no fear. And mm-hmm. y'all talk about how you had to work through your fear to create your new book, As Black as Resistance. And mm-hmm. so I guess I was kind of curious, like what were some of the things you had to work through as far as like fear?
I think for me personally, you know, yeah, we're thinking about our respective contexts, our respective relationships to to kind of racial capitalism. And for me, I think something that I'm constantly working through is class traitorship and what that entails. There's a certain level of respectability, that is a result of my like classed upbringing. There's no way around that. And I think that I'm constantly working through in certain situations, like what it means to like uphold these classed obligations that I was socialized into, and what it means to also refuse them, because I do believe that economic redistribution is the only way forward. And then I have to confront the sacrifices that I am willing to make in order for that to be actualized. So that's something that I think about a lot. The fear also of refusing to just keep creating to stop imagining a liberated world that exists solely through negation. So solely through the absence of some structure, the absence of some kind of oppression, and to actively attempt to put, to positively articulate the world, as something that we want and something that frees us. And that is very scary, because I don't know what that looks like. And so we have to be willing to make mistakes, but we are often very unwilling to allow ourselves the vulnerability of making mistakes. So those two things for me seem to be the most important things that drive or, you know, that constrain my kind of thinking and make me afraid.
Yeah, right on. I didn't imagine it would, the first one would have been one, but definitely, like, I think it's important to just, I guess that's why it seems important to me, is like, for any kind of revolutionary practice, you know, we have to admit that we're all just kind of bumbling in the dark here and just tying together all the best ideas that we have access to. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
and I think we have to be honest about the resources that we have at our disposal. I think that in calling ourselves workers and calling ourselves working class or whatever, yes, there's a term that is employed as a means of solidarity, but there are people who clearly have more access to certain material things, and we all have different material realities. And if we're not being honest about what exactly those are, then we get into this kind of ugly, murky space where we can often be co-opting and performing certain kind of classed identities as they are legitimations of our politics. And I think that that's something I see a lot. And that's something that I think is really ugly.
Right. Like, oh, I'm out here on the front lines, you know, I've got my trust fund. No one knows I'm sitting on like $100,000 and I'm eating at the free kitchen and,
Yeah. You know, people are struggling to fund projects. Like, why are you not, if you can, supporting that financially?
Right. Yeah, I've heard that critique not a lot, actually, but all right. Well, another thing that I thought was interesting, an interesting path that your book strikes out on that not a lot do, is typically with Black struggles for liberation, if they're connected to ideology, usually historically it's Marxist or communist. Mm-hmm. And in the anarchism of Blackness, you identify anarchism as like a set of practices, not necessarily as an identity. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, can you speak on why you are stressing anarchism and not more Marxist communist ones?
I think that we understand, I think we're looking at anarchism not necessarily as opposed to Marxism or communism, because I think we're both deeply informed by a lot of Marxist-Leninist, Maoist different works. But I think the reason that we're understanding this like autonomous framework is because of the Black position within the nation state, as opposed to being a part of the American nation state. And the way I personally understand Marxist-Leninist and a lot of these Marxist positions is that the emphasis is on some kind of capturing of state power in addition to building kind of mass movement. And I don't think either of us particularly have an interest in capturing state power. or moving or putting the state in this kind of trajectory out of capitalism. I think we're a lot more focused on not so much what happens after the revolution, but the way that we're attempting to build community infrastructure, autonomous infrastructures in this moment. And I don't think that that is incompatible with a lot of these kind of community projects that different communist and Marxist and socialist organizing formations are a part of. It's just more of what is the end goal? The end goal for me is not necessarily like prepping for some revolution as opposed to figuring out how we can alleviate suffering and support communities like in this moment.
I guess the reason why, I mean, another reason why it's interesting to me is typically like as a white anarchist, when I go around and say, oh, we need to, you know, abolish the state and to end white supremacy. There are a lot of people who say that it's a really privileged stance to say, let's, you know, let's not use the state as a means, as a vehicle for change, mm-hmm. because it's leaving behind people of color, for instance. What do you have to say to that argument that it's like sort of privileged to not address the state?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not under any kind of illusion that we can just ignore the state. And I think that if we successfully abolished the state and we didn't have structures that were in place to support or to kind of replace those abolished structures, that a lot of people will be really harmed. So it's like, yes, we want to abolish the state. And also there are people who are reliant on the state for like dialysis and treatments that we wouldn't necessarily be able to replace. And so this is not a politic that doesn't have like a grounding in people's material conditions. And so my politics, I mean, like, yes, in the long run, let's abolish the state. And yes, in the long run, let's ensure that we have all of these infrastructures that are able to support community. But like I said, I think we are a little less concerned with like what, I mean, the state's not going to go anywhere. Like, let's be honest. And so I think that there are ways that the state, yes, we need to continue. People are reliant on state resources. And also there are certain areas that we can divest people from reliance on the state if we are able to kind of mobilize resources and be very careful about ensuring that people's needs are met in that divestment.
And one thing I heard recently that I thought was really interesting by those folks in Habit, I don't know if you've seen that, but they were talking about pushing capitalism to the margins of our life. And I really liked framing it that way. And same thing with the state. If you just, you know, just gradually over the next 50, 20 years, push capitalism to the margins, push the state to the margins by building autonomy. You know, that's how we could gradually make that shift.
And also in our interpersonal relationships, like William, I mean, he didn't write this in the book, but he has this really good piece about the way that capitalism shows up in our interpersonal interactions. And I think that there are they're very useful and practical and actionable models around abolition that are not just about looking at the dismantling of institutions, but also the generation of new kinds of interactions and like reciprocal relationships and relationship building and emotional labor and everything. And like in pushing capitalism to the margins, we also have to look at the way that we understand people through lenses of like disposability. And the way that that shows up in our like romantic relationships, platonic relationships, organizing relationships and all of that. And I think the interpersonal is just as important, if maybe not more important, than this kind of like macro political vision.
Right. Like I have a friend who, you know, he's a graphic designer. He makes, you know, whatever, you know, $1,000 an hour or whatever. And, you know, I can get him to come over and smoke joints with me all day, but I can't get him to come over and help me weed my garden. You know what I mean? So, yeah. So in your book, you talk about how the state is anti-blackness. And since its inception, the state and capitalism has functioned through the exploitation and murder of people of color. I've heard it. I think it was Marx or Hegel. I'm not sure. But basically that rights are bullshit, that if you have to assert a right, it means you don't have it, essentially. And that this really reminded me, I was really reminded of this as I was reading your chapter about how you're talking about how people of color in the United States are like stateless, without citizenship.
Not people of color, black people.
But didn't you include, indigenous peoples in that as well?
Indigenous people as well. But not, this isn't, is not about like people of color. It's specifically about like blackness and then also indigeneity as these two groups that have been precluded from the social contract, from the Constitution, and from any notion of liberal rights within the United States.
Okay. Well, that's an important distinction. Well, so do you have anything to say about how, black people are essentially stateless?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, rights are tricky. Rights are important, right? Rights give us access to resources and services and privileges and some notion of safety, you know, in theory. But the problem sometimes with rights is that if someone can give you your rights, especially within the context of the United States, where black people have never been included within the social contract, and there is no desire to see free black people within the United States, then they can be taken away, and they are often taken away. And the enjoyment of rights is kind of conditional, dependent on like who you are and what your social location is. So they're not actually inalienable rights. They're completely conditional. And so I think that working within the system is important to some extent, in as much as you can extract resources and services, whatever you need from it. But then there's also an understanding that the very system that is built upon kind of black subjection, and needs to continue to flourish through the use and extraction of black labor and violence against black people, is not going to be the state that is going to protect you, is not going to be the state that is going to, affirm unequivocally black humanity. And I think if anything demonstrated it to us, it was the Obama's presidency, that we have a black person running the United States, but he was beholden to the kind of machinations of racial capital. And there's not, even if he was going to try to be good about it, there's not anything that he could do.
So in this context, can you talk about like the importance of self-defense and why that's like a big focus of your book?
Yeah, I think self-defense is really important to us because it's a refusal of respectability. It's a refusal of this conditional affirmation of black existence, right? Like it's a refusal to be like, this person is innocent enough to be like supported and understood as a real victim, but this person wasn't because they maybe actually had a gun. It's an acknowledgement that like all black people have a claim to protecting their personhood and their family and their community by any means necessary and always. It's not a conversation, right? Like it's not a question as to whether or not black people have the right to self-defense. It's an acknowledgement that black people are not suicidal, in this kind of like collective way. And yes, we can be not violent in a movement, but that does not preclude the use of whatever is necessary when push comes to shove, to protect ourselves and to protect our communities. There's so much black movement and liberation politics that would not have survived if not for people who were willing to pick up arms and defend black folks, especially in the South.
One example you have in your book is the NAACP head in, I think it was North Carolina or South Carolina. And when I think of the NAACP today, it shocks me to think that, you know, 50 years ago, they were arming themselves.
They were about it.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And there is also a particular, maybe a different level of urgent threat. Because I think that there was a moment, lots of moments really, where Black folks arming themselves was not so much like, I arm myself because I believe in armed struggle and revolution. It was just like, I'm arming myself because this is the difference between a lynch mob killing my family and them understanding that they will get shot at if they come onto my property. So there's that legacy.
Jesus. Another historical thing that you pull out that I thought I actually knew very little or next to nothing about is the Seminole War, and the Maroons as a model for resistance. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's something that we found interesting, and that's something that animates William particularly. Is I look at all of these kind of historical instances of like Black and Indigenous co-resistances. And I think those are really informing us around what a liberation politic looks like in the United States, because we can't have a Black relationship to land or a Black relationship to space and natural resources and whatever in the United States without acknowledging and without working alongside Indigenous communities that have been fighting for their sovereignty since before African people were brought to the United States. And so any understanding of liberation in the United States for Black people must be, must be conceived alongside Indigenous communities. And that was something that was kind of tangible that we could offer, as an example of what that looked like. And even something that was still messy, because I don't think that there's ever a way of doing that, work together in a way that isn't messy, because historical trauma is very difficult and people get very territorial over trauma. It's critical political work nonetheless.
What was interesting about the Seminole War conflict was that was the first Emancipation Proclamation, right?
It was these kind of Black folks and Indigenous folks fighting alongside, you know, one another in opposition to the state.
It just goes to show that the path for liberation was through armed self-defense.
Yeah, and it's harder than guilting people into voting.
So I have a good friend who, before Trump got elected, had pretty much lost patience with white liberalism and wanted to shift to working with normal people where she lived, who didn't want to go to weird ass meetings that had more revolutionary potential. Can you talk about how appealing to liberals appeals to innocence and respectability has failed, and why Black people should focus their organizing efforts differently? Particularly in your book, you talk about how Black Panthers, you know, emerge from situations that were imperfect, and how, like, what role gangs could possibly play in Black resistance.
Yeah, I think appealing to liberals is kind of is a losing battle often, because of how much your work starts to revolve around like assuaging white fear. And I think that there's something really important in understanding how liberals function to prop up white supremacy, because as much as they might not, you know, they might not be down with the violence, this naked violence kind of on its face, they are invested in a certain level of peace and security, which still comes at the expense of like Black communities and all kind of, you know, non-white communities. And so, trying to convince white people that things are going to be okay for them and they should, like, white people should be afraid of Black liberation, right? Because free Black people in the United States completely upends any notion of like safety and white supremacist order that they've been socialized into believing is necessary. And frankly, I don't care how afraid you are of that. My question is like, what are you willing to do to see Black people be safer and free and have agency? And if the question is, if the answer is, I don't have time for it. I don't have time for this like naivete of insisting that people be civil and have conversations. Because what are we even able to talk about if your frame of understanding is that I should not be allowed to like live and be free? How am I supposed to negotiate my existence with you? Like, that's like negotiating with terrorists. It's not a thing that, and that's why I tried to, you know, write about this Against Innocence piece, is this idea that there aren't, like, your support of Black liberation shouldn't be predicated on the idea that there are some people who are safe enough for me to throw my support behind, and there are some people who I can't support because it's tricky and they might have done bad things. And rather this idea that like all Black people have a claim to life that should be protected, full stop. And liberalism is completely antithetical to that. You had another question in there that I
forgot. Actually, just for some reason, I crammed two questions together. I don't know why. I don't know why I did that. But as you were talking, it reminded me of being at religious clergy led events in Denver for Mike Brown or Trayvon Martin, and they were very. It was very much, you know, calls to peace and respectability. And
why aren't you calling white people to peace?
Right.
Why aren't, you know, white people being gathered and people having very solemn conversations about how Black people need and should be left alone? Instead, the calls to peace come to people who are in this perpetual state of mourning, and anger and frustration and humiliation and we're supposed to be like, what does peaceful mean to us?
Subjugation. It's like, how come white preachers aren't asked to go on the news and denounce every time a cop kills a Black person, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, also Christianity would have a whole lot more to answer for if it were actually demanded to do that.
Oh man.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll ask the second half over again. So when you look to what revolutionary formations could look like in the U.S., you talk about the need to build coalitions with peoples whose politics might not be perfect or, you know, on the same, you know, same level as whatever, someone who went to college or has been hanging out in activist meetings for 10 years. And one of the things you talked about in your book is how, I think it was the Black Gorilla family, and how gangs sort of like the gang culture in California sort of helped lay the foundation for, the sort of organizing approach of the Black Panthers. And so I guess I'm just wondering, you know, thinking about that moving forward, you know, what are your ideas for what resistance could look like?
So there's a book called Black and Blue, and it's the memoir of Tukey Williams. And that it was honestly one of the most like beautiful books that I've read, and I cried kind of throughout it. And he has this line where he was like, "We would have made great Black Panthers, but the Crips got to us first," something like that. I think that we forget that Black gangs in America kind of emerged out of kind of like Black community sociality. Like it didn't emerge kind of as this like criminal formation, or whatever violent formation or whatever. And it is a thing that like evolved into that. But even as it evolved into that, it still plays a role in, kind of like community making. And I think that if we're going to be talking about a liberated Black people, it doesn't make sense to like do the respectability politic thing and only talk to people who have the vocabulary to talk about Marx. And obviously that's not to pretend that there are people who are in gangs who can't talk about Marx. That's patently false. But it's just to ensure that like no part of the community is excluded from whatever movements towards Black liberation we seek to make. And I think that like in looking at the prison strike, I think that offers us a really good opportunity to learn about what it means for people to organize across set lines. And there are people who are self-organizing and self-radicalizing. And I think that they're doing work that we should look to as transformative for us, and as well as something that we should be obliged to offer our solidarity to.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely like the idea of no one being, you know, excluded from movements, which of course, you know, makes public organizing often very challenging.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, in this vision, like, can you talk about the importance of creating autonomous spaces to this? Like, you know, in your vision, do you imagine like, you know, there are parts of the city the cops doesn't go and, you know, people set up their own clinics and food supplies and become a world unto themselves? Is that your vision? Like self-defense becomes generalized to the point where cops can't get away with false arresting, harassing and killing Black people?
In this world, there would be no police, but yes. I think the idea, I mean, especially living in West Oakland, the idea of having community clinics and resources that are not dependent upon the state, especially in this moment where things are, where kind of state enclosure seems to be escalating in gentrification. I think the idea of autonomous spaces is important, but it's more and more and more and more fraught, and it seems more and more untenable because of how hard it is to hold on to spaces. This is something that I think about a lot, and this is something that I really struggle with. I think, like, what does it mean to be able to have and hold on to and make available space to the community?
And then at a certain point, who's it for? By the time the place is up and running, everyone on the block has been pushed out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, is that how you see it? I mean, that's how I kind of see it. And maybe that's really nihilistic,
No, that is how I see it. It's a combination of, yeah, by the time you finally are able to hold down the space, everybody is gone. And so it kind of becomes what this novelty, but also, it's so hard to be able to access those spaces because who has the capital to purchase a building? Yeah, you can squat in something, absolutely, and hold that down. But I think like in the Bay, a lot of this becomes particularly difficult to think about because after the Ghost Ship fire, it's been really difficult for people who are in these kinds of unconventional live, work, warehouse, housing, whatever spaces, to hold on to them because the city is coming after folks for like fire code, safety code violation problems and fears and stuff like that, and is prioritizing access to property, prioritizing like developers, of course. And so, yeah, space becomes a thing that is so important, but is also so, we have such like a fragile relationship with the space.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, after the ghost ship fire in Oakland, like all the best DIY space, most of them in Denver, were just immediately shut down by alt-right trolls, actually, who notified the like 4chan assholes, basically snitched out all these places in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, but I feel like your book, you're really, you know, trying to think this all the way through, you know? And so it's like, I hadn't thought we'd talk about gentrification, but it's so, yeah, I just wonder, I mean, I just wonder if you have any more thoughts on that, like what the prospects are, you know? I think of like other places, like, you know, there's land projects beginning in the United States where people are removing themselves from cities and going and building communes up in upstate New York, or, you know, autonomous villages. They exist everywhere, all over the, mm-hmm. all over the world. Do you like, you know, but when you do that, you know, my question is, are we leaving people behind to do that? Do you think it's more important to focus struggles, to continue to struggle within cities?
I think that we can struggle in multiple sites. But I also, the only thing that gives me pause about the commune thing is that whose land are we on? And what is the relationship that we are cultivating with the people, with the original people of the land, of that land, of that particular area? And again, if our land projects aren't rooted in an affirmation and a respect for indigenous sovereignty, then we're just reproducing kind of like settler values. And that's not liberation. That turns into kind of this like selfishness of wanting to check out of capitalism and like live in this like communal setting, which I'm not pretending is easy, but, you know, you can kind of create an insular politic that means you don't have to maybe be as considerate about other kind of social political dynamics. But yeah, communes are land, and like land projects are cool, but, yeah, who has access to them? We can struggle in multiple sites simultaneously, I think. And I think we should do that.
Right. Right. Yeah. I've just been like almost 100% focused on urban struggle for a long time. And, capitalism and gentrification, they're forces that are so powerful, abstract, and fast. It just seems it's really difficult to fight it.
Mm-hmm.
So, well,
on that happy note.
Right on. Okay. Well, how are black movements like Black Lives Matter or movements like it, how are they pacified? Or what are some of the methods that whatever the state or the media would use to pacify, or funding would use to pacify movements?
You know, I think sometimes you can quiet people by making them a part of an administration or a campaign. Because then their messaging kind of becomes beholden to a political strategy as opposed to kind of a messaging for messaging's sake. I think that when certain political projects start getting funded by organizations, I think then you get beholden to your funders, and you don't have the same kind of agency in your messaging sometimes. Let's see. I think those are the kind of two main ways that I see it. Either getting absorbed into government or absorbed into a nonprofit complex, a nonprofit industrial complex, both of which can be, you know, kind of horrible in their own right.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, of course, a lot of that is true for almost any kind of organizing, how they're
classified. Totally.
Well, Oh, you know what? That's kind of like the main questions I had for you. But another thing I thought that was I had never heard before that was in your book. And I don't know if you had any more information on it, but about how and I think it's in the first chapter, y'all are talking about how before slavery, before black folks were stolen from Africa, many Africans lived in horizontal, egalitarian communities. And I'd heard that about indigenous people of North America, but I'd never heard that about Africa before. So I was wondering if you had any more information on that.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of indigenous communities around the world that are organized in this way. That, yes, there are people who hold particular positions of authority, but it's not as much this very rigid hierarchical structure that we see. And it's that kind of like this horizontalism that really inspires a lot of my own work and understanding of how to orient and kind of construct political formations. And it can be really hard. And I know that a lot of, you know, communist folks give us a lot of flack for that, for the lack of structure and authority. But I think that there can be something really exciting and important about that and empowering about that.
Yeah, I tend to be someone who loves when I'm like really caring about something, I like love my idea. But then every time I get in like a horizontal setting, I'm always very pleased at how the idea evolves and then comes back and it's like, oh, it doesn't look anything like I had in mind when I came into this conversation, but this is way better. Let's do that. You know?
Yeah. There's a much more interesting opportunity for like collaboration and co-creation when there isn't that kind of horizontal verticality in decision making and kind of the formation of ideas and agendas and stuff like that. But it's the horizontal organizing obviously takes more time and it can be extremely laborious. And that's why I can understand why people are like, this is inefficient and it sucks. Just do something different. But I also think that it's something that we should aspire to learn to do and to really lean into. I can't imagine that anyone would believe that conceptualizing what it means to be free is going to be efficient and not take a super, 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 super long time to do. So it's as long as, yeah, I think that that's a kind of labor that I relish doing.
Yeah. And especially when we see how it's functioned in places like Rojava and, you know, if people can't come to consensus on a decision, they split the group up and take half the resources goes one way and half the resources goes the other way. It's like, great, you know?
Yeah. Great. And also not. yeah. Great. And also not.
Yeah. All right. Let me put that. Fine. All right. Well, yeah, like I said, those are pretty much most of the questions I have for you. You know, is there anything new that you've been thinking about since you've written this book through like talks and getting out there and like feedback you've gotten from people? What are you thinking about now as you're, you know, you've been, this book's what, 6 months old, 4 months old?
A couple months old. It came out in June.
Okay.
It's like 2 months old. I was like, wait, what month is it?
Sorry, I got the book and then I moved around the country. For me, it's been like a year. So whatever.
You got probably an advance copy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's been out since June. I think something for me that I've been thinking about is, at one of the readings that I did in San Francisco, there was this indigenous person and he said something that I really appreciated, that I think my initial reaction was to be defensive. But it was only because I wasn't sure whether or not he was saying it in good or bad faith. And he was ultimately saying it in very good faith. And we had a conversation about it afterwards. But he was critiquing kind of the left in general for you know, whenever we talk about indigenous resistance, we tend to talk about like the Zapatistas and then Palestine. But there's not nearly enough of a conversation about a relationship to indigenous resistance in the United States and what our, and I think it's because that's a lot more difficult to conceptualize. And we can talk about, you know, fuck settlers and talk about all of these things. But when it comes to being introspective and thinking about our own relationship to settler colonialism and our own interactions with the structures of genocide and displacement of indigenous communities, it's a lot harder to turn the lens like on ourselves. And he, you know, afterwards he was like, and I appreciate that you all were consistent about mentioning it in the book and mentioning the importance of like grounding the politic in indigenous struggle, because that is something that is just very often neglected. When we have these conversations about nation state making and about like liberatory projects and land projects and everything. So I've been thinking about that and trying to just think about what it means to be in constant communication and dialogue around this issue with indigenous communities in a way that isn't just kind of name dropping and tokenizing. Yeah, I think that's what I'm really thinking about. And I think that was for me the biggest thing that came out in doing the tour. Biggest critique, biggest comment, biggest whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, a lot of times it's those sort of comments that, you know, make us a little defensive that are coming from a positive place that.
And I think I got defensive because I didn't know how to answer it. And I also think that like, it's okay to just be like, yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I don't know. I haven't thought about this enough and I'm going to think about it. Like that's a totally appropriate and in fact, encouraged answer sometimes.
Right. Well, I mean, even when we were talking about communes, you know, it didn't, I hadn't actually, you know, thought about it like that in the United States, even like if you're going to start a commune somewhere, like build those relationships, understand the indigenous relationship with where you're standing before you call it a liberated zone, you know? Well, yeah, I don't know. Thanks for, you know, thanks for taking the time. I know you're, I mean, if I had to hop on a plane to Africa tomorrow, I probably wouldn't have done the interview today. So I appreciate you waking up bright and early to do it.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to chat.
Yeah. Well, so if people want to grab your book, they can pick up your new book, As Black as Resistance, with William C. Anderson on AK Press. And if people want to learn more about you and follow your work, what's the best way to do it?
You can go to my website, which is zoesimudzi.com. It's just more just a collection of the different things that I'm working on. And then I am extremely on Twitter, way too much. But my handle is ZTSAMUDZI. Try to catch me before Twitter suspends my account permanently again. Yeah.
Oh, did that happen?
Yeah, I think a bunch of people must have mass reported a tweet that I wrote last year about how being a TERF will get you slapped.
Oh, yeah. I see.
And it got reported for threats of violence. And I actually got an email a couple of days ago from Twitter being like, we reviewed your account and it shouldn't have been suspended. Sorry. I was like, what? Okay. I guess that's how we're doing it now. We're just suspending first and then investigating later, but okay.
Crazy times we're in.
Yeah.
Crazy times.
Honestly.
Good time to get out of the country.
Yup. Yup.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks for taking the time and, I don't know. Enjoy your Sunday.
Thank you so much. You too.
Oh yeah, I'm on another one. Yo, I don't wear no capes or no tights. Before the family, I give my life. I don't fly, I don't have no x-ray vision. All I do is stay focused and handle my business. Don't be looking for no hero, gotta save yourself. That's why I walk with power in my steps, so my presence is felt. I don't brandish a heavyweight belt. I just strive to be an everyday help in the best way I know. I don't change up in the phone booth on the low, but I'm Superman to my youth, making sure he grow. He knows a hero is just a sandwich. We do it out of love, never for the glory. That's what a man is. Lead by example, set your own standard. Without the gamma ray enhancement, life is no fairy tale. The struggle, I know it very well. This is going out to the real heroes everywhere.
We are our own superheroes, fighting for our rights. We are our own superheroes. All power to the people.
Blast off, no dust or basalts. Mind in the cosmos, feet touch the asphalt. I'm an antenna between heaven and earth. I am the difference between death and birth. My persistent existence contradicts conditions. Let's be realistic, switch the statistics. Not to mention surviving this shit. White supremacist, police, and addiction. Life is a struggle, you face it and change it. Fighting for your right, survival is dangerous. Heroic, the notion and deeds of a poet. The system is weak, so the people overthrow it. That's what I teach to my seeds when they're growing. By the time they reach their teens, then they know it. I show it through my activity and focus. They see what I read, who they meet, and they notice.
That's what I can be. I am my own liberator. Say it, seek yourself. When you ain't